You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Feeling stuck in your job? Bank of America's The Academy for Consumer and Small Business helps you develop a long-term career path. Through peer mentorship, immersive programs, and a variety of clear and distinct paths, you can reach the next level in your career. Take your first step towards a long-term career path at careers.bankofamerica.com. That's careers.bankofamerica.com. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. If you're flipping around the channels this Wednesday night, you might stumble across a musical variety show that seems vaguely familiar and gets you nostalgic for the songs of the 70s and 80s. But I'm not talking about reruns of Soul Train or Solid Gold. In fact, I'm not even talking about a real show, technically, but a sketch show that brilliantly parodies those variety shows and funk, soul, and R&B artists from the 70s right up to today. It's called Sherman's Showcase, and today I sit down with the creators and stars of the show, Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin. They recall how they first began writing together at Harvard and skipped the typical Harvard Lampoon route into comedy, instead starting their own sketch group and getting in on the ground floor of the YouTube comedy boom. They reminisce about writing bits for Late Night with Jimmy Fallon and getting drunk with Lorne Michaels while working on their ill-fated HBO series Brothers in Atlanta. Diallo and Bashir discuss their secret to juggling two shows at once, Comedy Central's Southside and IFC's Sherman's Showcase. They talk about the musical variety hours that inspired their own variety spoof and how they lured some top musical talent, including John Legend, to guest star. They actually say most musicians are really secretly aspiring comedians. Plus, they reveal the LA neighborhood that becomes a punchline on Sherman's Showcase, and laugh about a real commercial from the 70s that featured the ghost of Frederick Douglass pitching hair care products. Coming up with Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin in just a moment. Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin just debuted their comedy series Southside on Comedy Central, and now they're also the creators and stars of a hilarious new variety sketch series that parodies musical variety shows of the 70s and 80s. Sherman's Showcase premieres Wednesday, July 31st at 10 p.m. Eastern, only on IFC. Diallo and Bashir, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ben.
What's up?
The show is really funny.
Thank you.
I think I watched probably about half of the episodes.
Great.
And I'm kind of in love with Sherman's Showcase because I grew up in like the 80s and I remember the shows that you're spoofing, like Soul Train and
Solid Gold.
Yeah, all of that. You guys don't seem like y'all are old enough to remember those shows.
Well, I will say that there was a formative experience in the 2000s where, like, just one day I got home from a DJ gig, I'm sure, and they had like one of those infomercials on for Bert Sugarman's Midnight Special.
Yeah.
And you know, this is the 2000s, so like 80s retro is like in full swing, and I was like, oh, Blondie performed on a show? Like, it was just like, you know, oh, that's all the Ohio players. Like, I was just like, wow, how cool is that? So I bought that DVD set and I watched it in my apartment alone for hours. And at the time, Bashir and I thought that we would write a show, ironically called The Midnight Hour at TBS. We tried to write a pilot for them that in some ways shares a lot of DNA with this show, in the sense that it was like a fictional late night show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot more like 30 Rock. I feel like there were times when we actually like left the set. And for Sherman's, we were like, the only rule of Sherman's that we're kind of adhering to is that like it's not 30 Rock. It's not one of the things where like you're necessarily going to follow Sherman home and like find out about his love life. Like it's not really right. That kind of show. Now that I've said that,
like
we'll
that.
Probably do that in season two at some point. Yeah. But right. I think that the fun thing about Sherman's is that we're really just showing you the show.
Yeah.
And the show is the comedy, which can happen either on stage during a performance, it can happen backstage, or it can happen during the fake commercial breaks, you know, where we throw to like, you know, the commercials that we do, you know, the trailers.
We wanted
something that was unbound. And I think that as artists, that's everybody's goal, is to sort of eliminate walls, eliminate rules, eliminate, you know, preconceptions. And I think with Sherman's Showcase, The irony of it is that it looks really specific because it's specifically about a specific type of American entertainment, which is the big variety show. The irony there is that because we've chosen that format, we are completely unbound.
Yeah.
I mean, if any idea that any writer has, I mean, that's what you want to be when you do sketch comedy.
Yeah.
Any idea any writer has is like, yeah, I want to do a sketch about the Temptations and all the other Motown artists trying to steal money back from Berry Gordy. It's like, we can do that. Well, I want to do a sketch about how whenever you hear a new hip hop beat, your face gets crazy, and I want to make a medicine that makes your face not look crazy. And we go, hey, we can do that too. So like, there's just no rules. And I think as writers, we have really set ourselves up for success.
And you cover like 40, 45 years with this show.
Future. So, I think people don't realize
a million places you can go.
Yeah.
I mean, the references alone, you've got, I don't know how many seasons worth that you can mine there.
True.
Trillions.
But one thing we actually want to do, I know that, you know, it's a Sherman Showcase has a lot of reference-based humor, but I also like to think that a lot of the humor just is us being us, you know, like, so we pull from a lot of different source material, but at the end of the day, we feel like the humor, in a weird way, is 100% original. And the songs, while they're supposed to remind you of certain artists and genre, we feel like the songs as well are very, very just original, like songs that we would listen to.
You guys wrote them, right?
Yeah, we wrote them.
We
primarily, most of those songs come from ideas that we've had for, you know, either a couple of years or they came immediately out of the room.
Yeah.
Okay.
I always give the example that, you know, I was talking about the song Funk Dat, which was like a sort of a novelty hit in the early 90s because he was like, just throw out like, man, when you paid your girl and she don't paid you back, man, Funk Dat. And like, I was like, wow, that is a simple structure for a song.
You could write 30 lyrics.
Just got to come up with a bunch 30 of scenarios.
Verses.
And you got your chorus.
Yeah.
And that's what eventually became the James Brown sounding, the James Brown-esque, I should say, song, That Ain't Right. You know, because he just throws out the things that are really obnoxious to, this guy is in the spirit of James Brown and the JBs and Fred Wesley, but at the end of the day, he's his own character. He's Jackie Redmond. He's played by Fonte from the rap group Lil Brother and also from the Foreign Exchange. And Fonte's got an amazing solo career right now. He's one of the musical collaborators that we got with to build out songs for the show.
That's why I like that sketch so much, because if you know, are familiar with Funk Dat or James Brown, the JBs, then there's so many little touches in there that I think you're going to love. If you are not familiar at all with that, it's really just a really funny song with a guy naming stuff he doesn't like. So, it works on both levels. Yeah. And I think whenever our comedy does that, we feel great. We're like, all right, this is working.
And I think I read that you're going to release an album, right?
And that we got an album coming out on Mad Decent, which
awesome.
Is Diplo's label. Yeah, in fact, to the listeners, I mean, like, we already have a Sherman Showcase Spotify list, which has, like, over 50 songs.
Nice.
Songs that, you know, are some of them are our original songs, and others are songs that we just felt like inspired, you know, the show in general. I'll even go so far as to say that when we were compiling that Spotify list, we looked over the list with Mad Decent. I wanted to make sure, and this is the DJ in me, I wanted to make sure that none of the songs were, like, you know, traditional songs by that artist. Mm-hmm. So you won't find, like, Prince you know, Kiss, the song Kiss, but you will find his offshoot group, The Family, and their song Screams of Passion, because I feel like, I feel like why not use this Spotify list to put people onto songs by artists or artist-related artists that are cool that they may not have heard.
Right. Yeah, and since this is a, you know, tribute to black comedy and variety shows of that era, I almost feel like you could even do a road show like the Jeffersons did.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't.
Like,
no. Can you tell me about that?
No, the Jeffersons for a while, they did like a road show just doing episodes of the Jeffersons all over the country.
Were
with
they
the
still
original
on a
cast
set?
And everything.
Did they just move the set around?
I don't know if it was the TV set or if they adjusted
well,
it or what
showcases.
It was. But like, I think
were they shooting
shows
exteriors? Were they shooting outside or indoors?
No, it was indoors. And they would just go to a theater and people would show up and it would be Sherman Hemsley and I forget what was the May
Jefferson's
Louise and all of them, and they would just do episodes of the Jeffersons.
That's
but I think a few different shows did that back
this
in the day.
Obviously why we love the internet nowadays, so we don't have to travel as far to do
don't
the
have
live
to leave
shows.
Your house.
Yeah. But the irony, of course, is that we absolutely want to do live shows. I mean, Showcase is built on the idea of live performance. These are songs that, you know, the artists can sing. We hope folks at home will sing along. And certainly
and
there will be
a
stage show.
And if you have a casino, maybe you're Sheldon Adelson and you're listening to this podcast. Like,
exactly.
We'll come play the Palazzo.
This is right up his alley, I'm sure.
What?
I'm sure this is right up Sheldon Adelson's
alley. Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
When he's not, I won't make that joke. When he's not giving money to Newt Gingrich.
Yeah. I think, you know, look, nowadays so many real successful musicians really live and die on the road. And I think for us, audiences are used to getting great stuff in live performance nowadays, and certainly Sherman Showcase is about to make its mark.
I mean, you've got just about everyone on this show. I mean, cameos from John Legend, more than a cameo from John Legend. You got Common, Quincy Jones, Morris Day. How did you get all these guys on board with this?
You beg.
Okay,
you make a phone call.
That's all it takes.
You know, I would say half of these people are people that we had encountered previously in our careers as just writers or in some cases as performers. You know, and so in those cases, it was like, hey, when we do this show, we want you to come on and do that. You remember that time you told us that crazy story? Or, hey, you know that crazy character that you have that you wanted to do? Like, you know, this was our opportunity to work with them. But then I will say that I was actually impressed by the fact we're a first season show. Nobody really knows what the show's going to turn out like. And yet we had people who trusted us enough for whatever reason, naivete, they were willing to come through season one and actually play with us when they've never worked with us before. And so, you know, I'd say it's like a third of them are our friends, a third of them are people who just trusted us, and a third are people who, you know, came through casting, you know, because there were some people who we just went through the traditional, like, reach out to their people, see if they're into it, and then they came through.
Did you find that a lot of these musicians are really secretly wannabe comedians and they were throwing ideas for sketches out
and
stuff like that?
You nailed it. I mean, Dave Chappelle has famously said that every musician, you know, every comedian wants to sing and every musician thinks they're funny.
Yeah.
And it's so true. And I think it's, you know, why are we able to get some of these folks? Well, I mean, outside of the, you know, either an appearance on one of the talk shows or SNL, which is a high bar to clear for most people, you know, a lot of musicians can just come to us and have some fun and be funny and show the world some other sides of themselves. So we got people like Vic Mensa and Fonte Coleman, and, you know, we even got like Sacha Gohart is a rapper out of Chicago. We got some big names. Obviously, your John Legends and Common came through too, but we also have people who are on the cusp. I mean, we have comedians who are on the cusp. And so everybody knows that we're even-handed, and we're like, look, let's all just make you shine as funnily as possible, because our show does best when everybody is really killing it.
Yeah.
And I'll even add one more thing to that, which is, you know, we often call that old show from 50 years ago, we call it Laugh-In, but it was actually Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and people don't realize that Rowan and Martin were writers, and they had good relationships with people all across Hollywood, and they were like, hey, come on and just do, hey, Mr. President, come on and say sock it to me, and then we'll let you go. Like, I feel like that's our mentality. We're like, hey, Tiffany, we'll have you try the soup, and then just,
you can leave.
You're done.
You're done. Shoot some more of your movies. You know? Give us 10 minutes, please.
Well, I know you.
Give us some pocket change, please.
Yeah, I mean, I know that you guys worked with Barack Obama on Slow Jam the News Fallon. You think you might be able to get him on?
Absolutely. Season two, I think he's going to be a big fan of of our work.
I'll go for Bo the Dog. I don't anything.
Anybody who knows the family.
Let's get Pete Souza. We'll do a whole thing a photo.
There you go.
I'll take Marion Robinson, Michelle's mom. I think she's probably funny. She's from Chicago, Southsider.
Yeah. Oh,
she
yeah.
She can come
yeah.
through, do some stuff for us. Let's get it going.
Now, speaking of Southside, I know that with Southside, you've said that that's a kind of a family affair. You have your wife working on it, and family, relatives, friends, and all that. Is it the same case with Sherman?
Yeah, actually, Diallo's wife is the head choreographer for Sherman Show, because she killed it. Our opening dance number, which many people who've seen it, we've had a couple festival screenings, and I've had people tell me that was one of their favorite moments, is that big, because I'm not somebody who you look at and go, oh, that guy's going to sing and dance. So it's fun, right? So I'm doing that.
My wife has often said that Bashir killed it, because she didn't know that Bashir could dance like that. Bashir's got moves.
Well, you know, I got my start in The King and I in high school, but here's the deal.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, totally. High school theater. Shout out Whitney Young. But, you know,
that may have been like the first, you know, colorblind casting for a musical. That was like probably pre-Cinderella and all that.
Oh, with The King and I?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh,
well,
probably.
I mean, your version.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was Chicago High School. They had to have some people of color in there, because most of the school was black.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, it's nice when, but you actually bring up a good point. Like, we don't really care. You know, we're black, obviously, and we love to sort of like cherish and support our traditions, but we also have to push it forward. We also have to say, what are we doing that hasn't been done? And so even though we have a format that is sort of historical and even a tad nostalgic, what it allows us to do is just do comedy that nobody else can do from as many different directions as they can do it from. And in terms of the family and friendness of it, we also tap heavily into that. You know, we were friends with John Legend before he actually jumped on the show as a producer, which is great, because we knew him as a guy who was obviously a megastar, but also somebody who just loved comedy and loved to be funny and was hoping to find an outlet where he could have some fun. You know, my sister's on the show. My wife is on Sherman's as well, doing a little sketch.
Yeah.
So it's just like Dial and I.
By the way, his sister, Zuri, not only just an amazing singer in general, she sings one of the upcoming singles off the soundtrack.
She sure does.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
No
kidding. It's called Drop It Low.
Drop It Low.
I don't want to tell you anymore of the title, because it might give something away.
I remember that scene.
We want that moment to hit Black Twitter really
Look, we're creators, but we're also fans, and we just love to watch people score. And I think if somebody is on our air and they're having blast and the audience is loving it, then we're always feel like, great, this is what we want to do.
I also want to give a shout out to we have a lot of animation on the show.
That
was all done by my nephew.
That's right.
My nephew Song Riddle did the animation on the show. I think it's already taken on a life of itself. It's adorning some of the t-shirts that Matt Decent will be coming out with later.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that's beautiful. If you can be able to create with the same people that you've been working with your whole life, and people who know you well enough that they get your humor and that kind of thing, I mean, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah, it
must be very rewarding to finally get to that point in your career where you can bring those people inside.
We have two passion projects, you know, and in both of those spaces, we feel comfortable in pursuing both projects to their creative, logical ends. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's nothing more, you know, comfortable than that. I'm sure that in the next, you know, 24 months, we'll probably start dabbling back into something that's like big broadcast with a million cooks. But I think that for right now, we're very happy with these two things that I think arrive at the screen in a very pure state.
Yeah. And IFC seems to be like a good place for that because, you know, I'm also a big fan of documentary and it does seem like there's kind of a sense of you're back in film school or something. And, you know, let's just do the thing.
Let me point this out. There are two things.
Not make it too crazy. Just have fun with it.
I fundamentally believe that there are two IFC shows that factor heavily into this show. One is Doc Now. And a lot has been made about the fact that, you know, both shows are fictional shows that have run through decades. Believe it or not, that part did not come from Documentary Now. That part was always, when we had this idea back in 2011, sitting at Fallon, we always had the idea of, like, you know, the two of us in wigs and singing songs and doing crazy stuff on stage over the course of, like, some span of history. But to give a shout out to Doc Now, the role that they actually played in this show coming together was they did that episode about Stop Making Sense and the Talking Heads. And aside from the fact that that sketch that episode had a lot of Tawny Newsom, who's on our show, you know, I told Bashir, I was like, we should do black music at IFC. We should do a show about black music. And we went in and we pitched it, and Pete Aronson, who's the head of programming over there, I forget what his title is, but like he was basically like, let's do this.
Yeah,
but
that's hilarious. I was an intern for him. That's funny.
Are you serious?
Tell a story.
Whit Thomas Productions at Warner Brothers when it first came out.
I hope you're listening.
Yeah,
we got stories.
That's funny.
But let me also say that there's another IFC show that we don't always talk about in interviews. There's another IFC show, The Spoils of Babylon.
Oh yeah.
And I, you know, we loved The Spoils of Babylon. It was so funny. And at that point, we knew that one day we would work with Matt Piedmont. And it doesn't come up enough. Matt Piedmont directed every episode of Sherman Showcase.
Yeah.
And I think his style, and also Giles, his DP, they have a way of shooting stuff that makes it just look like we had 10 times the budget.
Matt did like SNL and Funny or Die, SNL. A bunch of that, right? Yeah, he's terrific.
Yeah, we're big fans of collaboration, obviously. Mm-hmm. Guys who come from big families, so... You know, at every position, we want a player who's killing it.
Yeah.
And Matt, I mean, aesthetically, even if you've never seen these aesthetic touches all come together with this music, with the comedy, the whole thing, it's like this incredible machine that nobody's ever seen before. We're excited to cut it on.
You've never seen a Montel Jordan sketch shot like it was Jim Jarmusch.
Nobody had the boldness to shoot the Montel Jordan.
But if Jim Jarmusch shoots a Montel Jordan sketch, then it might look like that.
Were any of these ideas things that kind of germinated when you were on Fallon or other shows and they just weren't something that you could do on network TV?
I mean, you just nailed it. I think, you know, Fallon is a very specific audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we come from a more edgy place. And so sometimes we would have ideas that that he would love, but it just wasn't right for the NBC audience at that time. And so we're able to keep all those ideas. I think people always say that your first album is like 15 years of material. And I really feel like with Sherman Showcase season one, you really are seeing, you know, stuff that was thought of during the writer room process, other stuff that we had ideas for, you know, weeks and weeks before and years before, but all that stuff competed with itself in the writer room. And what you see on Sherman Showcase is the best of the best of all those ideas. And so we like couldn't have been happier with how it comes out. And then, we talked about Matt Deason doing the album. We talked about dropping the music video with Neo. These are all things that came afterwards because we had built something that was special. I think people saw that it was special and they wanted to throw in on it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin when we come back in just a minute. Imagine yourself with a doctoral degree, at the top of your field, teaching, researching, and making a bigger impact on your community. A doctorate is a huge step forward to achieving your goals, so what's stopping you? A doctoral degree may seem out of reach because of the investment involved, be it a time investment or a financial one. But you can earn your degree from Capella University through their flexible program, with online classes and a dedicated community of faculty and students just like you. If you're worried about the cost of your degree, Capella's there to help too. Eligible new students enrolling in select doctoral programs may qualify for a $5,000 or $10,000 scholarship. In addition to scholarships, Capella has a team of financial aid counselors, enrollment counselors, and career counselors to help you make your goal a reality, because you are an investment that's worth it. Learn more about the support and resources you'll have from beginning to end. You can also start by exploring Capella's programs and scholarship opportunities at capella.edu/kick. And now, back to the show. Now, you two have been working together, I think, pretty much for your entire career, going all the way back to Harvard,
your entire lives.
Too long.
But back to Harvard, that's where you all met, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, back in the old days, in the crazy 90s.
Back when Montel was still on the top of the charts.
Yeah. You know, it's rare to find people who you have a kind of similar, a comedic sense of humor with, a vibe with. And I think specifically... You know, when it comes to black comedy, sometimes it's so restricted. It has to either be big stand-up special, right? Or like big, wacky sitcom. And what we're trying to do is say, we love that stuff. Our work is going to feel unique. It's going to feel not like that because it's coming from us. And so now we're in a space where we can do something that has more curated touches like Sherman Showcase. Still hitting the big funny where we can, but the structure of it is going to be something people have not seen black comedy do before.
And can I say one thing about that? I think that the reason we've stayed together this long is because every day there's still that, you know, opportunity to be like, oh, dude, hey, check this out. Would this really be funny? Like, I text him, he'll text me. You know, we'll still text each other ideas for both shows because both shows sort of require different ideas. And even just sitting here and listening to him now, it makes me think that, like, maybe there's a version of Hidden Figures like a movie sort of like Hidden Figures, but it's about like the first black somebody who doesn't need a movie made about him. You know what I mean? Like, so like they were at NASA, but like I'm trying to think of like another, you know, sort of dreadfully seriously
hidden
shot.
For the right reasons.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's done nothing remarkable. He would be the number one chalkboard cleaner in all of
something. You know, like
Washington
I just,
High School.
I feel like there are just times when like, you know, just you get that tingle in your funny bone and you're just like, okay, I gotta. And if he likes it, then I know that it's, you know, I know that there's something there.
Now, did you two come up through the traditional Harvard Lampoon track?
No, we did not.
And I wish I could have. Yeah. If I could go up in a time machine, I would kill baby Hitler and I would sign up for the Lampoon.
I would sign up for the Lampoon, too.
Yeah.
I would just say that.
Did you know about that when you were there?
No, we were aware of it. But, you know, the Lampoon the Lampoon is a season. It's a magazine that lives and dies with whoever's writing it.
Right.
While we were there in the 90s, I would say the magazine was, like, not something the kids on campus were going crazy for.
It wasn't the talk of the campus.
It wasn't the talk of campus. And it wasn't until we got out to Hollywood. And then we realized, oh, he writes for the Lampoon. It actually super helps you get a job as a writer.
I heard every writer really good again right after we left or something.
Oh,
like
really?
That. And by the way, I know some writers who were on it while we were there. Yeah. So shout out to them. Yeah. I think we're just speaking our truth. I don't remember people outside of that immediate circle of friends talking about it. Mm-hmm. Definitely not at the Black Table.
Interesting.
The hot topic at the Black Table was probably like Biggie getting shot. It was not.
It's kind of embarrassing.
Did you see Page 36?
Exactly. Because we went 4 years at this place where we had this sort of like thing that would have gave us a leg up. And we were like, nah, I don't need it.
No.
Don't even know about it.
I'm going to write for the Harvard Political Review.
We're going to do it the hard way. So we were like, hey, let's do this the hard way. Let's just go out to Hollywood with no Lampoon bona fides.
I wonder if that helped, though. I mean, the fact that you didn't go the Lampoon route and, you know, straight out of college into a writer's room, you know, do you think that the fact that you didn't do that and that you started with sketch and did YouTube and all
you
that
know,
gave
go,
you some
I'll go
freedom
one further
to kind
and say
of develop?
That, I'll go one further and say that because we had to figure it out, we are sitting here. I think if we had done the Lampoon, I don't know how it would have looked, and I don't know how it would have affected our comedy, and I don't know if we would have had a different
sense of... We might
have
learned the wrong stuff.
We might have been guys who... Exactly, because you know what? Sometimes when you have publications that are like echo chambers, you know, I think what helped us is going out into the world and having the world be, you know, kind of hard. Mm-hmm. And then being like, all right, well, that's the real mountain. Let's go try to climb that
one. To this day, I've always felt like you're as... influenced by what you don't see is by what you do. And I think that there's certain things that I haven't been exposed to that I'm so happy that I haven't been exposed to, because it seems like everybody in our field loves them to death. And I'm like, okay, well, so everybody's been down that road and aped that. I'll continue to try to bring what I think is, you know, special and unique about my experiences or my likes to our work. And I know Bashir feels the same.
Yeah,
totally.
And you've kind of made your way by just going and doing your own thing. You started your own sketch group. And, you know, one thing that I always hear from comics who at some point started their own sketch group is they always did it because they found that they weren't getting the parts that they wanted at UCB or whatever. Yeah. Was that the case with you guys?
100%.
Yeah.
Totally. I feel like you must have read something.
We were both in two different sketch groups that were predominantly white, and
I would say they were
white. Yeah, mine too. And then and he'd be like, man, I'm tired of playing the co-pilot. I can't ever be the pilot. And I was like, well, they got me playing the cook. This sketch doesn't even have any reason for somebody to be making, you know, succotash. And here I am.
I'm a butler at the White House.
This is ridiculous. I can't play the president. So I think what it taps into is like, sometimes, unfortunately, even young people tap into like their sense of what Hollywood is looking for. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've seen time and again, whether it be with Seth Rogen and his crew, whether it be with Judd Apatow and his crew, like the people who I think really make the most noise are the ones who go their own way.
Mm-hmm. Or Issa Rae.
Issa Rae, they went their own way. They said, all right, that's what Hollywood is expecting. We're going to do our own thing. And I think, you know, I think we feel like victorious when we have things that happen because we went our own way.
Yeah.
Because there's even a version of us, and people don't realize this, where we were very content writing for Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. I'm not saying we were happy, because we had always wanted to make our own thing. It was a great job, but you know, you want to make your own thing. You want to be able to get from under the apprenticeship and go make your own paintings. Mm-hmm. And so we were in a position where we were very comfortable, very cushy job. Working in 30 Rock is incredible every day. You know, for me, I would literally wake up, go underground to a train and be at work in 20 minutes. It was a sweet gig, great money, good time off. But at its core, I don't think Dial and I got into this business to fundamentally support somebody else forever. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're proudest about this week and next week is that, you know, for the first time, we have our own babies appearing on television and standing on our own and showing the world, you know, what we love. And I think that has been just an incredible journey.
Yeah. Hallelujah.
Yeah, I mean, how much of Fallon was, you know, just 3 years of comedy school? Did you learn a lot?
I mean, I look at it more 4 years
later.
Over 3 years, and it was absolutely comedy grad school. I mean, we would put in some days. You put in 20-hour days. You'd get there in the morning, and you'd have to do the morning meeting where you look at the day's news. Are there any sketches there? Then you have to look at the sketches that are going in that day's show with Jimmy. You go in his office. It's a very rigorous process. You punch up, rewrite, punch up, rewrite. You got to go out and do rewriting. Then you have the afternoon rehearsal where you have to go down and do the sketches where you actually are going up. You have to actually produce them. Hair, makeup, costumes, props, put it all together. Then Jimmy comes and looks at it. He'll have more notes. Then you do the show, right? Then you can't make a mistake there. But then after the show, because Fallon was so prolific, we would also do shot sketches. We would do like the Real Housewives or 7th Floor West or whatever it was. And so then you'd have to go shoot that stuff. The only time you can shoot that stuff is after the show's finished. So once he's finished the show, that's 7 p.m. till midnight, 1, 2, 3 in the morning. You got to do it again the next day. So I really feel like we saw that as comedy boot camp, and which is why we feel so strongly that we were on the right path and we're doing our own thing, because we're like, hey, we know how to do this.
Yeah. Now, you later also got to work with Lorne Michaels, who was an executive producer on Brothers in Atlanta.
That's right.
What was that like? I always love to ask, because I find that everyone who I've ever had on the show has been on SNL always has a different but equally weird impression of Lorne Michaels.
I mean, he's a legend.
It's hard to talk about something he said without starting to imitate him.
Right, yeah.
It is weird. I feel like only recently have I stopped, like, sort of just, like, you know, that particular Lorne cadence, you know. But, you know, I feel like Lorne was very supportive of our endeavors at HBO.
Absolutely.
And he was there. So we spent almost four years at Fallon, and then we spent the next 4 years developing at HBO, and we shot two pilots over the course of that 4 years. Lorne was with us the entire time. And, you know, in between, like, you know, in between pilots, like, he would send us off and he would say, I need you to work with Maya. She's got a special coming up, you know, and then she'd go work with that. See, it's hard to say, remember what he said without sounding like him. And
flawless.
And then that's awesome. You get access to that whole stable of talent from SNL.
You got to take the island. I've never had one mentor. I feel like you got to take it where you can get it. And I always tell young people, you know, take it where you can get it. If somebody's going to give you, you know what's funny? We actually ran into Chris Rock one time randomly years ago, about 2007. And what he told us at the time was like, look, people are always going to push you guys to do just sketch, sketch, sketch. Mm-hmm. Try and do a series too. Try and write some longstanding, write your Cheers, you know, write your Friends. And so we hopefully with Southside, we have that series that's like original characters, people who America's going to really get excited to know. But the point of that story is that we ran into him and he gave us some advice and we took it. And so I always tell people, like, you're not going to necessarily get that sort of like classic TV mentor where you can go to their house every weekend and have dinner and they can advise your career. But if you're lucky and if somebody sees that you have some talent, they will drop some jewels on you, drop some knowledge on you. And if you're smart, you'll take it.
Yeah.
And so we were very fortunate that with him and even with Lorne, we were only with Lorne, unfortunately, for like 3 years developing off and on. But like, you know, whenever we would see him, we would have these long dinners late into the night, and he would give us his wonderful advice, and we
that
really
guy can drink.
To it.
Oh yeah,
can I just say, like,
let's get that going.
That man, he drank us under the table one night. I was just like, I don't know how you do this at this age.
Is he different when he's drinking?
No,
he's still warm. Change? It's still the
same. My theory,
or maybe
he's
just always drunk, and that's him drunk. I don't know.
You know, there's cool. Maybe he had a fake drink.
I think he had cranberry juice, and we were doing shots of tequila. We're like, we made it.
Don't trust the Canadians. That's all I'll say.
Now, you guys had this kind of roller coaster experience with Brothers in Atlanta because HBO, I think you dealt with executive switch around,
yeah,
and then they greenlit the series, and then they pulled the plug on you at the last
minute. We got a show on HBO.
We told our grandmothers, we were like, hey, we made it. We're on HBO.
What a fiasco.
I wouldn't recommend it to anybody to live through it, but I'm proud that we lived through it and came out okay.
I'll say it's even different than like when you get like a season two order. And then a couple of months later, they say, like, no, there's no season two. That was a thing at HBO for a little bit while we were there. No, they told us we had season one.
Yeah.
And we had a writer's room, and we wrote an entire season. We actually probably wrote two seasons worth of the show. It was tough. You know, it's one of those really stinging moments when you get the call, like, they're not doing it. But, you know, there were also some red flags, because, like, once we finished writing the season, we waited like months to get a production date, which is not normal. And we know that now. Yeah. Like, I think that's the other thing it was our first time to the rodeo, and we didn't know that the rodeo was going to end in a bull stampede to kill the audience. But you know, I think that looking back now, like, it's one of the reasons why I think Southside and Sherman's have come together the way that they have, because in both places, we made sure first, before we ever put one, you know, finger on a keyboard, that the studio and
the network,
the network really would this, really, that they liked us and they liked the project and there was never any weirdness and we never, like, you know, left wringing our hands like, do they like us? Like, that never happened.
And it makes me think of this one episode of Sherman's Showcase that opens with this little, looks like a five-year-old boy in a suit playing a network executive. And he hands you notes and says, these notes are meant to be additive. it felt like there were some personal
notes.
Yeah, it definitely felt like there was some personal truth to that one. Am I right?
Oh, there's personal truth in all our work.
Yeah, I think. No, go ahead.
I think what you also are realizing is that we realize that we're tough enough to take that type of catastrophe and go forward and still make something great and actually make something better than what we would have made before. And so I think with that sketch particularly, it's us showing you that, you know what, we still have a sense of humor about this stuff, and we can have a sense of humor. Because you kind of have to.
Look, I think we gravitate towards the tragicomic. You know, there's a certain gallows humor in our work.
Definitely.
I think at the end of the day, we have a lot of fun. And also, we think the network executives are children.
Yeah. Now, so then how did Southside happen? Were you just like, you know, well, we tried doing Diallo's hometown, now we're going
to do
Bashir's.
That's actually really, it's really close to it.
I mean, close to the Mark
method. We can't do anything until you have a great story. And so it wasn't immediate, but we did know that, you know, for us to do something in narrative comedy, we wanted to write our truth. And so we wrote the truth of Atlanta. Unfortunately, they stood in the way of that. But, you know, at the same time, one of my boys from high school, who's actually on Southside, Quincy, he used to work at this place called Rent-A-Center, where you can rent and like furniture and appliances.
Ads for
Rent-A-Center. I wouldn't recommend it. It's somewhat of a predatory business, but it also is, you know, unfortunately, like Diallo said, we have a dark streak to our comedy. And so when he would tell the stories of dropping off microwaves or picking up Lazy Boys, we were like, this is so funny. And it also provides a literal vehicle for the characters to just get out into the city of Chicago. And so once we have been talking to him, and once we realized there's a show here and it's set in Bashir's hometown, we felt confident pursuing what the story is, pursuing how do we make it real. But more than that, it's just like he says with IFC, we only took both of these shows to one place. You know, we saw the Stop Making Sense thing. We went to IFC with Comedy Central. They did this show called Review with Andy Daly, which I thought was really specific and crazy and funny and weird. And they seemed not to mess with it too much. And so we took them a show that we were like, don't mess with this. Please, just... You know, and what the good thing about Ken Altman was like, guys, I'm not going to do an HBO day. I'm not going to string you along for 4 years. If I don't like you, you're done.
I like how you make Ken sound just like himself.
I know, seriously. He sounds exactly like that. He's like a 1940s TV executive.
Yeah, he sounds
he's
like
chomping
an old
on
agent
a cigar,
in a movie. Yeah.
And he has like a full steak
borscht
lunch
belt
every day.
You know, agent is what we're going
Give me
for.
Shecky Green on the call.
Yeah, come on,
I like
you guys.
Style, kid.
You don't know anything about comedy, kid.
By the way, that's the kind of stuff that I like that we could do on Sherman's, which is like have like the cigar chomping, the boss. He always has initials for a name, like, hey, JP.
Yeah. And I love that one of the running gags on Sherman's Showcase is that it's shot in glorious downtown Glendale, California. Is it actually shot in Glendale?
Oh, it's actually shot in Glendale.
Holy
shot in Glendale. Yeah. And here's the good news. Like, I feel like we've been waiting years to put, like, just random parts of L.A. On blast.
Like Marina Del Rey.
Like, yeah, we did a song about Marina Del Rey, which I think is a really catchy yacht rock tune.
And it's then, on iTunes, everybody.
And it's on iTunes. But also, Glendale, like, it's such a weird place, and it just felt like a punchline from the second we landed there. So, like, on our show, the Mike Judge comes on, and he plays like the lieutenant governor of Mississippi, and he's just like, you know, he's talking about why they won't show Sherman's in Mississippi the way that, like, they wouldn't show Captain Kirk kissing Uhura in that one episode. And he's just like, we weren't going to let Sherman and his Glendale values, you know, like, there's just like this sense of using Glendale as shorthand for Hollywood. That just, I think it's really funny.
And it is a funny place because it's kind of part of the whole system.
It's part of LA.
There aren't really any studios there other than, like, I think one local studio, but it's just kind of this weird.
Yeah, well, we're at Quixote. Yeah. We're at the Glendale studio. Yeah.
And I love it because it kind of reminds me of when I would watch The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson as a kid.
Burbank.
And Ed McMahon would say, you know, live from beautiful downtown Burbank. For me as a kid in Texas,
that's where
I just thought, wow, man, really like Burbank, California, that must be the promised land. That's where everything happens.
And then you get there and you're just like, wow, Burbank is really flat. And it's all horses. It's like 10% of the population is horses.
Well,
but it sounds exotic.
I have to ask about how you manage these two shows, because, you know, you both created and star in two different shows premiering within a week of each other.
It's so easy. All you got to do is don't sleep and neglect your family.
Yeah. Okay.
It's really not complicated. If your kids need something, don't answer that. Okay. Don't help. Don't be there for anybody.
I blocked my kids.
Exactly. Okay.
I haven't seen my wife in weeks.
Okay. That's why you just bring the family on the set, right?
We did one after the other.
Yeah, exactly. Bring them to set. That's what you do.
You know, as I said with Fallon, I think we really had an education, and we had almost like a grad school education on producing and writing comedy and being good with turnaround and also being able to wear multiple hats. And we were even doing that before Fallon, because before we got there, one of the reasons he liked us is we were writing and producing and starring in our own sketch comedy videos for YouTube. We even had one of the first viral hits with us, one of the first written viral hit, which is crazy, because to go viral, you know, you had to be doing like History of Dance or something. We went viral with something that you actually write, and we were like, all right, cool. So when it came time to do our So when it came time to do our two shows, we knew we couldn't do them on top of each other, but we knew that if we did them one after the other one, we'd be able to give them the space to breathe. And also, they come from very different writer rooms.
Right.
You know, in some ways, Southside has a lot of rules. Sherman's is really specific looking, but it's designed so that there are no rules. So it actually allows us to both have fun with different parts of our brain, too.
From a production and logistics standpoint, is one easier than the other?
No, but I will say that, like, it's just the nature of the beast. Like IFC and Comedy Central, they have different budgets and different timelines. And you usually take about 4 months in writing Southside. And, you know, Sherman's, we usually pull together in about 8 weeks in the writer's room. And also just moving to Chicago and shooting in certain months in Chicago, because, you know, weather-wise, it's difficult to shoot in the winter.
Yeah.
It's hard to get the insurance and all the waivers that you need to
shoot. Right, and Sherman's is pretty much all in studio.
Sherman's,
right?
We go to Glendale. Yeah.
For now.
We literally hop on the 134, and then we drive down there, and then we're home. You know, we get to go home every night, which is
Fun. We actually use, in some ways, we use the limitations of Sherman's as a bonus. 100%. Mm-hmm. I think for viewers who are really into film, you know, there's another reason we're on IFC, because they really encourage experimentation. So, for example, we've always wanted to write this spaghetti western.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than, we're going to go outside and shoot it in Glendale because so many parts of it are just deserted. And we were like, this is perfect. Two blocks away from the strip club is like, there's nothing to do. But then we were like, but wait a second, why don't we use this as a challenge rather than do a company move? And so what our great director, Matt Piedmont, did was that he used a lot of rear projection. Also a lot of like funky camera moves, him and like you said, Giles, and also our production designer. And so what we do is actually do something that's totally in studio, but it doesn't feel compromised.
Yeah.
It feels like a specific choice. And actually, as Matt began to show it to us, we realized, you know, we had a couple other ideas we were going to do outside. We're like, no, let's do them here, because it makes the show feel more specific, and it makes it feel like we're the only TV show where you have rear projection exteriors going
on. It's movie magic at its best. and Matt, to his credit, is not a big guy. He's not big on CGI or those kinds of things. He's really practical effects.
We think audiences are going to really love the fact that everything feels tactile and analog.
Definitely.
And it doesn't feel like, you know, they shot some dialogue and then they got in front of a green screen. I don't think we used a green screen at all.
It didn't look like it. I mean, the costumes and the sets.
I don't think there is. Yeah. There may not be one green screen in the whole series.
Yeah,
we love the
feeling. It's terrific.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just before we wrap up here, I have to say, Frederick Douglass has gone down quite a bit in my estimation since watching Sherman's Showcase.
No, I think you might be referring to Frederick Douglass. Yeah. Which I would point out.
Gotten the last episode.
You have him selling action figures and shilling for show companies.
So let's embargo that. Let's embargo that. Forget anything I've said.
Any guilt about that?
No. What I'll say is that the Frederick Douglass thing, you know, again, truth is stranger than fiction. If you type in Frederick Douglass commercial, you will be directed to like a 1974-75 Soul Train commercial where this guy was having trouble with his afro, and he opened his bedroom door and Frederick Douglass came in.
That's a real thing?
You can look it up right
now.
Oh my God.
So we saw that.
We should promote that before the show.
We should tell people we didn't just come up with it.
This is not random.
But here's the thing. It's one of those videos that was, you know, among certain friendships was kind of viral. between us, it was like, yo, there's an ad where Soul Train did an in-studio ad where they had this old actor play Frederick Douglass and fix this dude's afro. And so what we did was said, well, you know what? We're going to do that in every episode because they have shown us the light that you could write something so absurd and yet somehow feels totally right to that world.
100%. Unbelievable. So do you have any sacred cows on Sherman's Showcase?
No.
No, not
nothing
really.
You wouldn't touch?
We haven't found them yet.
Yeah.
We don't even have
but
any
we're
real
vegan,
cows
so,
yet. So, yeah.
You know, we do respect cows, just not
we
the
like
sacred
cows,
just not the sacred ones.
Not the sacred ones. Yeah. I love that.
Well, Sherman's Showcase premieres Wednesday, July 31st at 10 p.m. only on IFC.
Yeah, yeah.
Diallo Riddle and Bashir Saluddin.
There it is.
Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Diallo Riddle and Bashir Salahuddin for coming on the show. Their new series, Sherman's Showcase, premieres Wednesday, July 31st at 10 p.m. on IFC. And also be sure to catch their show Southside on Comedy Central. For more fun stuff about Sherman's Showcase, visit ifc.com. And Bashir is not on social media, but you can follow Diallo Riddle on Twitter at @Diallo. That's Diallo with two L's. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.